welcome to the back room of politics and further discussions on the topic of climate change.
But I'm joined today by Dr. Rod Carr, who is chairman of the Climate Change Commission. The commission was established in late 2019 with broad support across the House, because there is an understanding that this is a problem not only for New Zealand and not only for our individual communities, the way we live, but internationally as well. And we do have to do our bit because we are a trading nation, and to be any kind of a pariah in the world would be very bad for our well-being, let alone our prosperity. Dr. Carr, the Climate Change Commission is accepting what challenge?
Jerry, it's a pleasure to be here, and the opportunity to have the conversation is highly valued. So the challenge that was given to the Commission by Parliament, with 119 of our 120 members voting for the legislation, was to provide independent, evidence-based expert advice to the government of the day on how we might go about achieving the targets that Parliament had put into legislation. And actually, the number of targets is very, very small. It was that we should reduce biogenic methane, and that's largely from agriculture, but also from waste, by 10% from its 2017 levels by 2030, and by between 24% and 47% by 2050, and that by 2050 we'd be net zero in all the other long life gases. So those are the statutory targets. Parliament agreed to them, and it did say, all right, we need some advice about how we might get about that. And the advice comes in two packages. One is around what are the emissions budgets? In other words, how much could we emit each year to be on a path to achieve those targets? And what policies would we need to have? What general direction of policies should government adopt if they're going to achieve those emissions budgets? So that's the job. We provide advice. We have no decision-making power, and the government is required to consider but not accept our advice.
Now, all that sounds good, and those targets at first sort of hearing seem not all that challenging, you know, to drop a quarter of a volume, if you like, over a long period of time on the one hand, and then I think, did you say 17% on the biogenic?
Yeah, biogenic, 10% by 2030 from 2017 levels.
So that seems okay, and as I say, when you first hear it, attainable. What's it practically mean, though, for all of us who are out there trying to do our bit?
So I think the first thing to recognise is New Zealand is unique in many, many ways. But one way it is unique is the composition of our greenhouse gases. By global warming potential, as it is measured internationally, half of our warming effect comes from emissions of biogenic methane. And we're an outlier. The country which is closest to us is Ireland, and only a third of their global warming contribution comes from agricultural emissions. So we've got a bigger challenge to reduce that warming effect than any other country. And that's why the Parliament agreed we should split the targets between biogenic methane, largely agriculture, and all the other gases. So the challenge is that there is no readily available known technology or alternative for ruminant pastoral livestock, i.e. the stock like sheep and cows, that eat grass and then digest it the way they do. There is no other technology to reduce the biogenic methane emissions apart from breeding and feeding. And the breeding practices, you can look at a herd and you can determine there's a trait in the herd where some of the animals are more efficient at converting their dry matter into meat and milk. So you breed for that trait. And we've done the research more in sheep than in dairy cows, but we know you can get a reduction over time as you breed for that trait. And we do know that different feedstocks help reduce emissions. So when it comes to that half of our greenhouse gas emissions, there's not much that most of New Zealand can do about that. They're not farmers, they're not researchers, and they're not about to run around and help farmers adopt different practices. And that's why our advice is the government needs to invest more in the research to help find those breakthroughs, but also support farmers to become more knowledgeable and apply those known better practices. So we urban New Zealanders can support the government in its support for the research and adoption of those better practices by agriculture in New Zealand. there is about 10% of biogenic methane emissions that come from waste, and that's largely waste that is not landfilled and gas captured. So that's another way that urban New Zealand can insist that its waste stream is reduced, recycled where possible, and appropriately managed at the end. The other half of the emissions, the largest share, over 40% of that half, comes directly from transport, how we get around. And we are not going to hit our targets unless we do something about the combustion of fossil fuels in the open air in our transport fleet. The known available technology to achieve that is battery electric vehicle technology. The Commission was careful, though, not to say that that's the only bet. There are other bets. It could be fuel cell hydrogen, and there's certainly a part to play by us where we can, walking, biking, and taking public and shared transport more often. But the Commission was also clear that there are some parts of New Zealand and some people and families for whom biking more, walking more, or taking public transport is not an option. And there's no point in blaming and shaming people for behaviours they cannot change. But we also know that if we invest in better, more convenient public transport, then it is more likely people will be able to have it. If we invest in more and safer cycleways, people are more likely to use bicycles when they can. But even in our forecasts, 60% of all the vehicles on New Zealand roads in 2035 will still be internal combustion engine cars. We are not advising that we scrap or ban existing in-country internal combustion engines. We're saying let them reach the end of their life, and when it comes time to replace them, make sure we replace them with low or no emitting forms of transport.
And those sort of availabilities of alternative fuel source vehicles is going to increase, I think, in the years ahead. You've got to look manufacturers and some of what they are saying. Yeah. Availability to New Zealand, though, may be a problem. And I see today there was a report that even since the government announced the subsidy program for electric vehicles, that the second-hand price has already begun to rise, which is one of those things that is counter to that type of subsidy. What is the assessment, though, on what the availability might be like? I noticed in your very long document that you produced, very thorough document, some 400-odd pages that most people are not going to have the time to read. Even for me, I've got to say there are some graphs in there. I'd like to talk to you about those because I think they're not overly clear.
Yeah.
And I think there's some work that could be done to make that so. I've lost my thread now.
The availability. Even if you want them, even if you can afford them, can you get them?
That's the one.
And look, there are a couple of reasons. First of all, it helps in some ways that New Zealand is small. Often it's cited that the problem is New Zealand's small and the big motor vehicle manufacturers don't care. They're building markets and brands and New Zealand's too little to count. But the flip side of being small is we actually don't need a very large share of what the world produces and has available. So there is no doubt, if you look at the scale up of production, that there are going to be many more new off the production line, low and no emission vehicles coming our way. And there will therefore be more in the second-hand market as well. Not everybody will be able to, will want to, or will be able to afford to jump to a pure electric car, right? But plug-in hybrids and low emissions vehicles are options that will help reduce New Zealand's transport emissions. So if a hybrid is a good deal and a good thing to do, then that is one thing you can do when you're ready to swap out your vehicle.
So this might be initially for a second family car, for example. So if you still want to occasionally tow a trailer or a caravan or whatever it might be, you have a vehicle that'll do that, but you might consider some kind of either very low emission. So I know in my household we've got I better not say the brand of it, but it's a small SUV, but it's only got a 1,000cc engine. Yeah. It's turbocharged, but it is incredibly economic. Yeah. And you certainly don't, when you're driving it, notice that it's some kind of low-powered vehicle.
Yeah.
So those, I suppose, are the sort of choices that that people can make. What other household choices can people make? So if away from agriculture and away from transport, there's still a chunk there that comes from other sources. So manufacturing, for example, and I think your document
talks particularly about food manufacturing. But what in a household sense or in a consumer sense can we do that we could just be a little bit conscious, say, if I make that choice, I might reduce just a little bit the overall emission profile. And, of course, collectively across the 5 million, we make a much bigger difference.
Yeah. So I think every household is different, and particularly when younger people have asked me, so what can I do? I don't have a lot of money. I'm not a major director of a company. I can't influence a lot. And there are four things which I often suggest they can do. One of them is mindful purchasing, exactly the point you're making, Jerry, is that every time you go and buy something, you're voting for another one of those things to be put back on the shelf. So being a mindful purchaser and thinking about, if I can buy it once and it's going to last longer, that may well be better for the planet. If I can do with two of these and not four of these, if I can reuse, recycle, all of those things are pushing us in the right direction. But they don't universally apply to everything all the time, and it doesn't necessarily apply in every household. The second thing, apart from mindful purchasing, is to have the kind of conversations that we're having now, is to talk it up, to talk about it in a non-confrontational, non-adversarial way that says, we, the civilization we've built on this hyper-connected, high-energy civilization, needs to transition. And if we're going to transition, we need to talk about it, not deny it. We need to be inclusive about it so we don't alienate groups in society who feel there is nothing they can do and they're being blamed or shamed, because that is not going to help us with the sustained journey we need to be on. The third thing I often say to people is, don't forget your employees in a business, and you can influence how that business thinks about its emissions in both its supply chain, its actual process, and its channels to market. And so you can have more influence sometimes at work than you can at home. And then finally, it is important that in a democracy, we challenge our elected leaders to the point where we can have confidence they know and understand the issue and the opportunities that exist for New Zealand to make a transition, because there are very real opportunities, but they do require change. They require us to lower some of the barriers to change, build some of the enablers for change, and help include everybody in the change. And I think those are ways in which we can all participate.
I want to come back to transport and agriculture shortly. But one of the biggest purchases any household makes in any week, apart from providing for their mortgage and the exorbitant council rates that we all seem to have to endure constantly, it would be the supermarket shop. Mm-hmm. So practically, what would you do or would you suggest in that case? We've just seen very successfully the banning of the soft plastic bags, the carry bags. And a lot of people are a bit up in arms over that. I think everyone's got used to it. Yeah. And they're certainly happy not to see them blowing around the streets as they often were. And now we've gone to, I think there's a deadline for 2025 of getting rid of soft plastic packaging inside supermarkets. So what can hasten that? What are the choices that people can make?
Well, I suspect, you know, that the simple choices are making sure that if you have the opportunity to select things that are not packaged in plastic, it's some slight inconvenience to yourself. You may have to pick out the individual pieces of fruit rather than buy the pre-wrapped tray of fruit. There may be opportunities if you think about the energy intensity of various processed foods to think carefully about the supply chain that gave you that processed food. Did it come from a manufacturer that's burning coal, or does it come from a manufacturer
that's avoided that? See, that's the part that might be a bit hard. And I think that's a place where the government could do more work in that consumer affairs sort of space.
But that's a
different topic.
It's not entirely different, because you're right. How do households make choices if they don't have information? And one thing governments can help with is making information available in a standardised way that is understandable by consumers.
Yeah, and certainly I would say just on that score, something a little simpler than the numbers system on the recycling would be useful because it seems to me it changes, or maybe I just haven't picked it up enough. But that point you made about choosing what you need and perhaps not too much, food waste is a massive problem in New Zealand.
We, in our final advice, after some representations from the waste management industry, actually increased the amount by which we think we can reduce emissions from the waste stream by the application, diligent application of technology and gas capture at landfills and directing organic waste either into appropriate reuse composting or into landfills. But that process is going to involve some households in adopting different behaviours about how they deal with the organic waste and how much of it they make.
Right. Well, that's something that practically people can start to get their heads around, because it's one of those things, you know, we hear about climate change. You used the term warming before, and I think, you know, people at the moment, as we hear in winter, would be wondering if this where this warming is. But that's also part of the climate change aspect, isn't it? And the number of big weather incidents that we now seem to be having. Just going back to the transport issue, firstly. And in a way, farming as well. I wonder if, in fact, we're looking at all this, and I began to think this reading your document, we're looking at all these bits and pieces quite separately. Well, in this, you know, in the case of transport, we're going to reduce by this, we're going to be doing these things. You can't help thinking that there is a whole lot of embedded legislation, RMA stuff, traffic laws, you know, health and safety laws, all sorts of stuff that get in the road of some choices that might be made. I know a lot of people would have an electric bike, for example, in the household. I'd look a bit silly. I would look like a circus act if I was on one. But
so would I, Jerry. I can't see the road well enough.
Between us, we might get there.
Yeah.
But they might make that choice. But it is that safety thing. You worry about getting clipped or something like that. So, yes, cycleways, various things like that. But ultimately, there is a question that has to be made about, well, even if we change our modes of transport, we're still going to need roads and how they're paid for.
Yes.
Because we're just not cutting the mustard on that even at the moment. Mm-hmm. And if you have an electric car at the moment, you don't pay road user charges, you don't pay registration charges.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That won't last forever.
Correct.
But we do have to have something that's equitable across everyone so that there's no sort of preference and a choice that's made. Do you think that is the case, that there should be a broader look at all of the laws that might stop us doing some things that would be good for, you know, the reduction of that output of CO2? Yeah.
I mean, it's not at all surprising that we've built laws and regulations around the known technologies of our time. And the combustion of fossil fuels in the open air was a known technology of our time. We've come to understand that not only did it have the immediate health impacts by the air that we breathe, that was self-evident in London by the 1850s, but we've really come to understand that even if you can't see it and taste it, it has this pernicious effect on the ecosystem that we rely on to sustain our way of life. So when we come back to, you know, if we think about transport, it is about doing what we can as soon as we can, acknowledging the circumstances that confront everybody are different. And I think that's when you come to how does government look at its regulations and its impacts, as you've been describing, and peel them back one at a time to make sure, for example, in the case of road user charges, where they're levied through the petrol and oil system, that is going to be a diminishing source of revenue as we defossilize ground transportation. But the roads are still going to be needed, and they will still need to be funded, and they'll need to be funded largely by the users of the roads. So at the moment, the electric vehicle fleet is so teeny, the amount of foregone revenue is trivial. But as that switch happens, so by the late 2030s, well over half the vehicles on the roads will be EVs, we are going to have to charge differently for how we develop and maintain that roading infrastructure.
In 2009, I was energy minister and party to the decision that made electric vehicles exempt from road user charges and from the registration fees. There were 18 electric vehicles.
Not a lot of lost
registered
revenue.
On the road. No, not at all. But it was designed to encourage.
Yep.
And the uptake, even over that time, hasn't been
massive. We're at about 23,000.
But the quality of the vehicle you can get now is massively increased.
Yeah. And the price point is much lower.
Yeah, what do you say to the people who come up with the argument, well, look, those EVs have got terrible batteries in them and they've got to be disposed of, and by the time you manufacture the car and dispose of the battery, no net gain?
Yeah, so the first thing is that's why we think the transition needs to be well signaled and well paced, so that we're not scrapping the already existing motor vehicles before the end of their life, because you are then throwing away.
I'm talking about the electric vehicle.
But that's why the phase through is important, and why the EV uptake rate is important. But what matters is the whole of life emissions, right? And so if you're saying I'm scrapping my internal combustion engine car early and bringing forward the purchase of a replacement vehicle, then the whole of life energy equation is much higher. But if that internal combustion engine car was going to get to the end of its life in its usual way and be scrapped, then the embedded emissions in creating the new car would have been embedded at least largely in whatever vehicle you had chosen. Now we'll come to the battery question, because there is no doubt that there's a bit of angst around the idea of stacks of batteries that can't be reprocessed. So the first thing to recognise is that there are already emerging second life uses for car batteries, that the kind of battery you need in a car to kick it into action and keep it moving is a dramatically higher energy kick than you need for storing energy in the house or business setting. So the repurposing of once were car batteries and EVs into electricity storage options are real and present today. But inevitably, you do get to an end-of-life moment, even with batteries, and there is emerging technical capability to recover 97% of the elemental components of EV batteries for reuse. And so as the stream of battery products come to their end of the life, the economics of repurposing and recycling grow. And finally, I'd say it's much easier to manage and contain a waste stream of batteries than it is to manage and contain the waste stream from combusting liquid fossil fuels in the open air at every point of emission. And so I have a lot of confidence that if you look at this on a whole-of-life basis and we transition to EVs, not abruptly but over time, that we will find ourselves with both a soluble battery problem and a much lower emissions over the lifetime of the vehicles.
That's an explanation that almost explains why we have the Climate Change Commission to look at these things and to understand these things. There is also, and I've been guilty of this myself, the suggestion that the electric vehicle subsidy is not the way to go, that it actually makes very little difference to the overall emissions from our transport fleet over the period for which it's going to run. I think it's less than 0.5%. It's quite a low figure. I think someone told me it's 0.4%. 0.04%, very, very low. Is that something that you've looked at, or is that, or are you looking at it from the point of view of let's send the signal?
Correct. We are specifically under the Act required to give government advice on the direction of policy, and our level of advice on the direction of policy starts with you have to decarbonise ground transportation. You can do that by getting more people to walk and bike and share transport for routes that they would currently have covered in internal combustion engines. You could get there by having more people who have their own privately owned and operated vehicles have low or no emission vehicles, and you need to do that in a certain time frame. But the exact calibration of how much you give who to do what by when is the level of granularity and policy that other agencies are best placed to advise government on.
Are you happy with that policy that's been announced from a commission's point of view?
From the commission's point of view, what we do say above all else is we have to get started now in setting in play a whole range of things that will change the profile of New Zealand's emissions in agriculture, in transport, in energy production and use. And that every little bit counts, because one of the risks with this is the argument that, well, nothing matters very much. You know, only 4% of emissions are actually from airline travel, and New Zealand only contributes 0.17% to global emissions. You can marginalise every emission to the point where it doesn't matter. And you enter what the economists call as the fallacy of composition, is that when you add things up, they're not just the sum of the parts. And my emission might not make a difference and the world might not notice, but when you do it for 8 billion people, it does make a difference and the planet does notice. So when it comes to a particular policy instrument, it is interesting because who gets a subsidy is a well-researched part of economics. And it depends entirely on the price elasticity of demand, which is the responsiveness of demand to the price, and the price elasticity of supply. And so the more inelastic it is, the more price doesn't matter, determines who gets the subsidy. Is it the producer, the importer and distributor, or the car buyer? And what I think will happen with the subsidy is two things. One is New Zealand will be able to get a better share of the available cars. In other words, the producers and importers will get some of the subsidy benefit. And some New Zealanders may be able to access some of those cars a little bit cheaper than they would otherwise have got them. And that means they may bring forward their purchase. But the observation that it also impacts the value of all cars is true, to the extent that the newer cars are seen now to be better, then it increases the interest in all cars of that type. So relatively, the interest and demand for those cars now increases as well.
Just not wanting to confront you with a whole lot of negative stuff. I mean, one of the other things that is commonly talked about is, well, it's not, and you touched on there saying it's actually the whole world's got to do something. You know, New Zealand doesn't matter because we're so small. You've covered that quite well there. But what is your observation, the Commission's observation of countries like China and India, the United States, where they have, you know, supposedly very large emissions, et cetera? One thing I will say, I remember being at a conference where the Indian Minister of Energy had talked about taking so much of that Indian community. He thought about 600 million people were using dung every day as a heating fuel. Yeah. And he was talking about the emission saving that they would be able to achieve by swapping it out with kerosene burners, which, well, he actually had good numbers for that. It was a positive.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a transition thing. But I think what it demonstrated to me was that even in a big country like that, where you've got, you know, deep cultural sort of practices, they were trying to do what they could.
Yeah. So some data is sometimes helpful. So New Zealand's gross emissions of greenhouse gases measured on this GWP, global warming potential, over 100 years, is about 80 million tons per annum. So for 5 million of us, about 16 tons per annum for each man, woman and child in New Zealand. Even if we set aside all of our agricultural emissions and say, well, we're basically doing that and feeding other people, not ourselves, we come down to about half of that, so about 8 tons per New Zealander. China, the manufacturer for the world, accused of burning all the coal, is 4 tons per capita. So we are twice per capita what China is. Now, there's a lot of more capitas in China, right, than there is here. But on a who's using the planet's resources the most, we're getting more than our fair share. And if you look at India, they're about 4 tons per person as well. So, you know, we're at 16, half of it for agriculture. We're still twice what India, China do for each person who is living the way we live. And you observe that in some of the data about the amount of waste that we have in New Zealand. Is we are profligate and we've got away with it, A, because we are relatively wealthy, and B, because our country is relatively empty. It's not because we are relatively good at looking after our resources. The next thing you'd have to say is that over history, it's estimated that New Zealand has put about 0.3 of 1% of all the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere today came from us, largely from converting forests into grazing lands, right? And so one of the things the Paris Agreement says is your historical emissions do count, that you've made yourself wealthy today by drawing down on the planet's ability to absorb these greenhouse gases. And so if you were a big historical emitter, you have a slightly bigger part to play in getting us to where we need to go. If you're a richer country, you have a slightly bigger part to play. But the kicker is really, if you've got some technology options that you could use, you should use them. And if you choose not to use them, that's your sovereign choice. So New Zealand chooses not to use nuclear power. One of the ways Britain is decarbonising is using nuclear power. We choose not to dam more flowing water. The way the Australians are reducing their emissions is through Snowy River 2, a massive hydropower project, but we choose not to. Some countries will reduce their emissions in agriculture from genetic engineering, but we choose not to. So these are all sovereign choices that the world respects our right to make. But what we're not going to be allowed to do is make all those choices and then say there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, can I come back to that the electricity issue shortly? But just going back on agriculture, and you just mentioned there that half of our tonnage per capita comes off from the agricultural stuff. What do you say to those who say, well, look, we'll meet our climate change requirements on our farms by dropping production, but that will mean that production is simply exported to some other country and we miss out on the value of it. So why would we do that?
Yeah. So a couple of things I'd say is it is true that our greenhouse gas emissions per kilo of milk and meat produced from ruminant pastoral agriculture is among the lowest in the world. That is true. We do agriculture that way as efficiently as anybody else. The challenge for that sector, though, is that consumer preferences, new technologies and foreign regulators are going to have a bigger effect on what we produce and who buys it than local regulators. That the next sort of part of that conversation is the agricultural sector has for decades said we need to go upmarket. We need to get a premium for what we produce and how we sell it to. The consequence is that to then argue that some low-cost alternative is going to meet that need is somewhat debatable. The lamb chops we supply are not direct substitutes for other people's lamb chops. It's not clear that if we don't produce it, other people will. Other meat will be produced. And I think the other thing is that if you look at some of our agricultural exports, for example, my understanding is that about half of our beef exports end up as ground meat in hamburgers, where it would be unlikely the consumer has any idea of the origin of that protein. And that as soon as the hamburger guys figure out how to get a plant-based substrate at lower cost, that would likely threaten New Zealand beef in that particular supply chain.
That's a very frightening prospect, so I'd like to stop on that. And with only a few more minutes to go before the general listening audience, I'm told, starts to switch off, if they haven't already. The electricity situation seems to me in New Zealand to be a bit of a mess at the moment. So we are not going to be exploring for a lot more gas. Currently, we've got Huntly burning coal. We're importing that coal. And we also have the gas turbines turned on. We haven't invested heavily in hydro schemes for quite some time. Lots of them are little ones that could have been useful, have been knocked over. What are we facing as a future if we can't get that sorted out?
Yeah. Well, we have to get it sorted out because our future to decarbonisation is through alternative sources of energy. One major one is electrification of low and medium temperature process heat and ground transportation. And that electrification requires predominantly, but in the Commission's view, it doesn't have to be exclusively, renewable energy, right? So even out in 2050 in our demonstration pathway, there is still coal being used in steelmaking in New Zealand and there's still fossil gas being used in the system. So we think that there are going to be massive investments in renewables. We're going to have to reconfigure our generation portfolio and that needs to be underway now. It needs to be informed by a 30-year energy plan, not just an electricity plan. We need to be able to signal to private investors with some degree of certainty the guide rails that are likely and share as much as possible as the pre-competitive information about the best estimates for future demand and technology uptakes, and then let the suppliers go together.
Can I just say, thing I picked up in your report was the assumption that Tiwai will shut down in 2024. So we have, every few years, Rio Tinto get all sort of high horse and they're about to leave, and unless there's some cash on the table or some other deal done, then they're off. We in government, we were at one point, we did assist them and got them to stay. the current government, we were in a discussion with them at a time when they were actually running the whole four pipelines down there, but at the same time threatening to leave, mm-hmm. which I found really interesting. Mm-hmm. They seem to have toughed it out, but we don't know exactly what the price is that's been renegotiated out to 2024. Mm-hmm. My pick is they won't go because they're a big international company. They've got to look at their emissions profile, mm-hmm. and that is one of only two plants in the world that use electricity to the extent that they do for their processes. So without that shutting down, what does that mean?
So in our demonstration path, you're right, we assume that that power is made available to all New Zealanders after 2024. It's about 12% of our current electricity generation. But we also run a scenario where it's not, and it's not available for one of two reasons. Either Tiwai stays, or that power is block sold, for example, to make hydrogen for Japan.
Right.
But from New Zealand's point of view, it's not available to add to the supply. The consequence of that is that it is likely that the wholesale price of electricity will be about $20 a megawatt hour higher than it would otherwise be. But it turns out it has very limited impact on the emissions profile in the next 15 years, which is counterintuitive. And the reason for that is that already running an EV is way cheaper than running an internal combustion engine car on petrol. So if electricity at the wholesale level, which is only a third of the total cost of electricity, was a little bit more expensive, it just makes the relative advantage of an EV operates a little bit smaller. So there is no direct pass-through to the EV take-up rate.
It's not just EVs, right?
But I just say one of the biggest additions is there. In low and medium temperature process heat, it turns out that the biggest driver for some take-up of biomass and biofuels is the proximity to a waste stream from forestry, and that is already competitive with electricity currently priced with Manapouri supplying Tiwai. So sure, the price of electricity wouldn't fall as much, but it already doesn't need to compete because biomass is better than coal, right? So from those points of view, it is really, because it was counterintuitive when we did the work, that why does Tiwai staying or going affect the electricity price by $20 a megawatt hour if it's available to all New Zealanders, but doesn't appear, at least in the next 10 to 15 years, to have a major impact on the emissions profile. And that's the explanation.
Well, that's very interesting, but it does point to the fact that our energy policy, if you like, or energy planning, does need to be a little bit better and a lot more long-term than it appears to be at the moment. Because that transition to that biomass, you know, that's just not going to happen in the next 3 years, which is quite a problem.
Correct.
Look, I think we should start to wind up here. One of the things I did want to ask you about is, in your report, you've got several recommendations about the reporting of progress, mm-hmm. effectively.
Yeah.
I wonder if it shouldn't be put together in a way that is very understandable for all New Zealanders and regularly published mm-hmm. in a way that we say, put them through the social media, whatever, so you have a look at it and say, how are we going? What are we doing?
Yeah.
Because we do need to get a much bigger buy-in to all this we've got at the moment. The voice that says, oh, it's all rubbish, and, mm-hmm. you know, if we're going to have this increase in global temperature, then, you know, go and buy some coastal land. Well, coastal land down on the south coast, just outside Bluff. It's fantastic.
Might,
you know,
get warmer.
Well, that type of thing. I mean, no disrespect to those communities. I've got a great deal to offer, but you get my drift that there's sort of this crazy stuff that gets talked when reality is actually happening all around them.
So we do have a statutory responsibility to monitor how a government is going against its emissions budgets and reduction plan. So ours is advisory, and in the end, by the end of this year, the government will need to adopt emissions budgets out to 2035 and an emissions reduction plan for the first budget period. We then get to say, okay, the government, our elected leaders, has chosen that plan, and every 2 years we will report progress against their plan, not against our advice, but against their plan. And that's why, to some extent, we've given an indication of the kind of progress indicators, but we won't know what they should be until the government actually says, here's our emissions budgets and here is our emissions reduction.
So for a simple mind like mine, we used to have almost daily reporting on smog in Christchurch during the winter. That's mercifully something we don't have a problem with so much these days. Is it possible to have something like that that says, you know, on this particular day, our emissions from the vehicle fleet was X?
I'm not certain about the vehicle fleet, but I know we can get it from the electricity production stuff.
Well, on vehicle fleet, we know how many litres are sold every day.
Yeah, we know how many litres are sold every day. We don't necessarily know how much was driven every day. It depends how precise you need to be about it.
Okay.
But we know with electricity...
Wouldn't that average out, though?
It may do. But what the Norwegians found interesting enough was as people bought EVs, and now I think they're past half of new vehicle purchases in Norway are EVs or hybrids, people kept their old internal combustion engine car parked in the driveway because of intercity range anxiety. They then didn't use it very much, and then its tank of gas went off. So when they turned around to use it, it wouldn't bother me. So I think what we do know is in transitions, numbers get jumpy. But in the generation of electricity, as we already know, we're burning coal. You know that, I know that. You can see that by the week, basically. So we've already got some indicators that are quite granular. The next stage of that would be if we do believe that we need to displace some travel journeys with more of those journeys, not just recreation, biking and walking, but of those journeys that were previously taken using internal combustion engines, we may need other data sources than we currently gather data for. And so that will be part of the monitoring function. And you're right, if we can create more of a dashboard that helps New Zealanders see meaningful progress as a result of their choices and behaviours, then that is going to be really helpful.
Well, Dr. Carr, can I thank you very much for your time today. And I hope that people can see that when politicians make those wonderful 7 and 9 second statements about various things, there has been a huge amount of work that's been done behind the scenes to get a better degree of understanding so that the choices that are made politically, as Dr. Carr has said, are well informed. So I wish you well with the continued work of the Commission. Thanks very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.